I'd like now to welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe Betty Booth. She is Santa Fe Green Lodging Initiative Coordinator with the Santa Fe Watershed Association, and Evadne Giannini is here. She's with Hospitality Green, an environmental consulting firm, and we're here to talk about green lodging. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Charlotte.
So, green lodging, that basically means taking the hotel and hospitality industry and making it more earth-friendly.
Exactly. The Hompa Santa Fe Watershed Association got a small grant from the EPA and contracted Hospitality Green, who are experts in this field, to work with the hotels to green their operations, which reduces the amount of water used and the amount of chemicals that go into our watershed, which is so critical.
Right. And so water is the main part of the initiative?
Well, we have a sensitivity to water. The Hospitality Green, our central office is located in the heart of the Catskill watershed. We, as a people and as living there, we steward the largest water availability for 14 million people of New York City. We're very passionate about water. We understand water pollution, water issues, and actually water conservation. It's the key cornerstone of some of our work, and it's partially why we are here. So the work that we'll do with the green lodging industry is very much geared to looking at water, water pollution, water conservation. It is also looking at the full paradigm of resource usage within a hotel to try and move hotels to, as much as possible, a zero-waste operation. So we're looking at energy use, water use, waste use, chemical use, and labor efficiencies. They're all part of sustainable operations.
That's very challenging, because one of the things that I've noticed traveling is that, first of all, you go to a hotel, they change your sheets every day, which at home you do every, what, 1, 2, 3 weeks, whatever. You get all these little plastic bottles there, and it's, you know, they change your towels, and it feels very luxurious and all of that, but it's incredibly wasteful.
Absolutely, and it's looking at each and every one of those little details. You know, coming out of the environmental world, we used to always call it grabbing the low-hanging fruit.
Right.
A lot of what we do is we say grabbing the apples off the ground, the things that seem so fundamentally that we could change easily. And many of the hotels in Santa Fe are already moving to doing things like shampoos and those world in dispensers, really being much more obvious of what has to be done in training of a staff for things like towel changeouts, etc. And it's really moving each of those pieces a little further down the road.
So let's talk about water conservation. How do you do water conservation in hotels?
There are multiple strategies. We can start with the number one fundamental that EPA and we have known about for a long time, is that 60% of water conservation will come from behavioral habits. So that in itself is a very big challenge.
What does that mean, behavioral habits?
In other words, what you and I do, how long we take a shower, whether we're willing to put aerators on our faucets, how we defrost food, how we really handle our pools. 60% of water conservation comes from our behavioral habits, so it's challenging. But in the hotel setting, we can look at water conservation from aerators, shower heads, urinals, cooling towers, how we handle the water, laundry systems, heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems. These are sort of what we call the issues that are the backroom issues of hotel work. It's really getting into the systems and the system technology, but they're all very much a part of what we do.
There's also issues of the chemistry that goes into the water. And in a place like this, what goes down the drain eventually ends up in a river or somewhere, and so it's very important to know what it is that you're pouring down the drain, because somebody told me this expression, I don't know if it came off a bumper sticker or what, but it's like, you can't throw it away, there is no away.
I love that,
and
I've always loved that.
Yeah, same with water.
Well, that's a very, very large part of our work, and we're also going to be doing some work on that with the Santa Fe Community College, and that is really helping hoteliers understand what real green chemical use is. We advocate using third-party certified chemicals only in the hotel setting, in the common areas, and in your hotel lodging areas.
What does that mean?
A third-party certifier has taken a chemical, worked it through its entire chemistry, looked at the manufacturing of it, looked at the product itself, looked at what it says it can do in comparison to another chemical. It's really what's being required at the federal level, at multiple state levels, and at the healthy hospital level for all chemical use.
And what kind of chemicals are we talking about?
Anything.
That do what?
Anything. Any kind of cleaning process. You can do all-purpose cleaning, you can do degreasing, you can do mirror cleaning, you can do floor cleaning, tile cleaning, carpet cleaning. There are over 1,800 products that are currently certified through either Green Seal or Eco Logo on the market today for the hotelier to use.
It's very interesting because I noticed at home, I was in Germany not too long ago, and I found out that bleach is illegal in Germany.
That's
you
right.
cannot use
That's
bleach
right.
in
That's
the entire
right.
nation of
That's
Germany.
Right.
And I use bleach from time to time to bleach my white clothes because they get dirty, and bleach is an extremely efficient way of cleaning your clothes. And then I'm thinking, if it's illegal in Germany, what should I be using? And of course, that peroxide stuff doesn't work for anything. And what are you supposed to do? So I would think that would be magnified thousandfold for hotels that use white towels and white sheets.
Well, I would like to say that peroxide doesn't work, but as I always say, not all peroxide is created equal. And quite honestly, when using peroxide, oftentimes we have to look at how we use a chemical versus what the chemical is. Hydrogen peroxide requires a short amount of dwell time, much like using an enzyme in any of your cleanings, etc. It will not clean right away, so you can't spray it on and make it happen right away. So a lot of it is a re-education process of how the product is used.
Very interesting. Now, what are some of the other issues in terms of chemistry?
We can work very hard to try and get people to think about what kind, how much of the of their prescription drugs they're flushing down toilets. We can also help people to understand that coffee is a really difficult contaminant to work with in our water systems.
Coffee? You're kidding.
Yes.
What's up with coffee?
Felicity Brennan was really great to come into our training, all of our training she's been participating in, and really explained to us that in the filtration systems here in Santa Fe, coffee really creates a bit of an issue with how it's handled through the filtration systems. We, of course, in upstate New York, advocate putting our coffee into our compost, our exterior composters, so that we can get the moisture into the compost without having to use water. And it would really be fun to, at some point, look at that in some of the smaller operations to, say, set up a backdoor composting operation, put all of that coffee, leftover orange juice, water, etc., into the composter so you're not having to use fresh water.
But what does it do to the water?
It's a question that it's difficult in the filtration process. It's really outside of my expertise to explain.
You mean what filtration process? The wastewater treatment?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
I wish I knew more about that chemistry, but it is something that is difficult in wastewater treatment.
Something that I've become really concerned with is, I mean, we have a problem which we well know, which is overuse of antibiotics. And
Absolutely.
So we are killing our own interior flora, which we need very badly in order to survive and have an immune system and all that kind of stuff. But we're also doing this really stupid thing, which is using antibacterial soaps and antibacterial hand things and all of that. That goes into the water system and it kills algae and all kinds of very important living organisms and microorganisms. Nobody
Absolutely.
Understands that.
It's, you know, water is funny. You have to pull it from somewhere, then you use it, and then it seems to just go away. The fact of the matter is that it doesn't go away. We have to continually think of that as a very closed-loop system, and water is probably our closest look at closed-loop. So, absolutely, and that gets back to that 60%, Mary Charlotte, of what we are going to have to do to really look at water conservation and water preservation. It is so much an issue of what we personally have to commit to and what we do.
We're talking about the Green Lodging Initiative that's happening here in Santa Fe and happening really all over the country, perhaps all over the world. I imagine that there are countries that are ahead of us in doing this in many ways. But another thing that I would guess, and you can tell us about this, would be helped by really examining what chemicals you're using for cleaning is indoor air quality. Sometimes if you go into hotels, especially cheap hotels, like that use these, what do you call them, room deodorizers. It's disgusting. It's really toxic.
Well, you know, there's very, I don't want to say that it's within the last month and a half, but I think it is within the last 2 months. There's a really wonderful website for the consumer, which is EWG.org. And EWG.org has, under federal legislation, the federal law says that we do not have to put the chemical compounds of what is in our cleaning products, et cetera, unless it is poisonous, meaning unless we drink it, we're going to die. It will sometimes describe something if you're going to put it, if it gets into your eye or whatever. But EWG has gone and rated chemicals based on EPA's standards of chemical use. And you can look on that website, look up the chemical that you like to use, chemical meaning product for cleaning or whatever, and it grades it with an A, B, C, D, or an F, and it also gives it information on other chemicals that you can use that are a little bit better than a D grade or a C grade. It's very fascinating what's on that site.
Now let's talk about the hotels and places of lodging here in New Mexico that are signing up for this.
Absolutely. We had tremendous energy and excitement about this opportunity. It's the first time that it's been offered in Santa Fe. And we have 14 of the leading hotels and bed and breakfast from La Fonda on the Plaza, El Dorado, Santa Fe Sage Inn, Casa Kuma Bed and Breakfast, Silver Saddle, which is a lovely little place down Cerrillos, mother-daughter owned. The other exciting thing about the initiative is that we started with a working group that's made up of both the public and private sector. And so we have the Santa Fe Convention and Visitors Bureau has really kind of been leading this. But we also have the New Mexico Lodgers Association. We have the City of Santa Fe Water Division and the Environmental Waste. So the working group is really driving this. Another important lodging facility here that's involved is the End of the Five Graces. So it's the leading lodging providers in Santa Fe.
Very interesting. Now, I would imagine that there is a movement to try to get chain hotels and motels involved with this as well. I mean, it'd be amazing if every Motel 6 or La Quinta or whatever got into this as well.
Actually, you know, we tend to not realize that sustainability and looked at in the lodging industry is an international initiative. Marriott has a very aggressive sustainability program. Hyatt has an aggressive sustainability program. Crown Plazas have an aggressive program. When you get into the corporate entities, it's a little harder to dig down into the individual shoes of each of the properties. But each and every one of the major chains is addressing this. They might have started to address this from the issue of actual cost savings through energy provision, but more and more they're looking at this because we no longer have what is called the green customer. We've been talking about this green customer. We've really moved into customer expectation 100%, that you as a customer anywhere from 20 years old up to 55, yeah, up to the last 40 years, you've been recycling, you expect it when you walk in. It's much like walking in and wanting a toothbrush. So we're really talking about now, what does the customer expect and what can we deliver in the hotel experience?
So there's a cost saving. So, for example, if they're more efficient about sheets and laundry and more efficient about water, that's a win-win. The environment wins. The hotel doesn't spend as much on those things. What about where there's conflicts, like in a hotel where people expect to basically stand for 45 minutes under a waterfall and that's their shower? Things like that.
You know, I think that what has happened across this country is that many of us have experienced severe droughts, bad storms, and that water has taken a different way that we're looking at it. I would like to say that I think fewer and fewer of us want a 45-minute shower. And as that continues to change, as we look at what's happening in the Midwest, if we look at what's happening here in the Southwest, that becomes almost a non-issue. We're more inclined to look at a hotel to say, are they paying attention to this as well?
Are there other places where there is a conflict between green and customer needs?
There will always be these moments of customer perception against the hotel or with the hotel. And it's really the hotel that then works with those. If the customer has to have the 45-minute shower, then the hotel can utilize that gray water in a different way. And as Felicity and I both totally agree upon, it seems rather silly to be flushing fresh water down a toilet. So there are many hotels that are looking at utilization of gray water so that the customer can have that half-hour experience in the shower, but then we're going to use their water.
And then the other part is to have those. I remember when I was in college, they installed these aerator shower heads, and everybody thought that we're no longer showering, we're just being sprayed on. But then when you stand under them, it turns out that you're having a perfectly good shower and you rinse the shampoo out of your hair and they work. And so under those circumstances, your water use is cut by 3/4, so you can actually stay in there longer.
And we've gotten even smarter about that. We can now put those aerators into a giant shower head that looks like we're getting 20, you know, gallons to the minute. And you stand under it and you see this giant shower head, and you're not looking at what I used to call the camp shower heads, which were those little skinny ones. And so we are perceiving that we are getting the same amount of water as we used to, but not necessarily.
Now let's talk about the Santa Fe River in particular. How is the river benefiting by, or do we expect the river to benefit by these initiatives?
We definitely do. What was interesting in the training that we've been having with the hotels is that people didn't realize that 45% of our water comes from the Santa Fe River. And so whatever we put into the river stays in the river until it stays in the river. And so the idea that we only got 6 inches of rain last year and we get 45% of our water from the river made people really sit up and think about water and how they use it in a different way. So there will be less water used and there will be less chemicals put into our watershed because of this. And one of the wonderful things about having Hospitality Green with us is that they have a very rigorous tracking system to audit exactly how much water is being saved, how much trash is being saved, reused, how much fewer chemicals will be going into the river. So we'll be able to report that to you in another 9 to 10 months.
You can come back on the radio at that time and do so. What about garbage? How are you addressing that problem?
Well, the first place that I like to address it is say I don't want it. I mean, what we really look at in the hotel environment or an industrial environment is what do you actually not need? And I think every household should say, do we really need it from the very beginning? Then we don't have to recycle it, we don't have to throw it in the trash, or we don't have to reuse it. So we look first to literally pull apart the entire organization and say, what in this organization do we actually need to be purchasing? If we don't purchase it, we don't handle it, we don't store it, we don't dispose of it, and so therefore we're not having to deal with that whole cycle.
And what kind of things get eliminated?
Well, do we really need single-serve cups? Is there some other way to handle that? Do we really need single-serve water bottles? Do we really need that? In a large hotel, perhaps we'll have 15 or 20 different staff, and the staff will go and order all separately from Office Max or something like that. If we coordinated the shipping, then we only get one cardboard box, right? So we look at, and if we have paper, does everyone need to have that information, or can that be put on an internal intranet so that we don't even have to pass the paper? If the guest that is coming at the hotel says, would you please, I need a receipt, do you want it by email or do you want it by paper? So therefore, we're not having to even use the paper or figure out how to handle the paper from the very beginning.
What about food waste? I have always wondered why restaurants and farmers didn't have a close relationship, particularly pig farmers, where you can basically take a lot of food waste and your pigs will gladly, happily devour it.
In all of these things, we look at them as a system approach. And in a food service operation, consistency and efficiency are the key to it. If we can create in that food situation, in that food preparation, a consistent way for them to divert that organic waste to a farmer, great, it can happen. It depends on the size of the hotel and the size of the operation.
Meaning what? Bigger operations have a harder time doing it? Or?
We do not have here in Santa Fe or access here in Santa Fe to a large commercial composting operation. If we're a small hotel, a B&B, or for a small restaurant, we can put a closed container out back that will handle just our vegetable food scraps, divert the liquids that are coming out of our operation, and put that in and do composting. It's a little harder in the bigger operations without a commercial site close.
Are there other cities that have commercial composting sites?
Almost definitely. Seattle, Washington has banned all single serve from the downtown area. There's no longer single serve independent individual plastics or any of that in the downtown area of Santa Fe because Seattle has Cedar Grove Composting, which is a commercial operation.
What do you mean by single serve?
Individual cups, individual ketchup cups, individual paper trays, all of those have to be compostable, and all of those are thrown into the general trash, which is then taken to the compost facility. There's no longer recyclable or even non-recyclable plastics or cups or any of that in the downtown area of Seattle.
Have they banned plastic water bottles and
yes.
soda bottles?
I don't know if they have banned plastic water bottles at this point. I'm not sure.
So what are some of the hotels who have been really the leaders in the green lodging initiative? In Santa Fe.
La Posada hosted our launch, and we really want to thank them. And we want to give a huge shout-out to La Fonda on the Plaza, and particularly Sean Murphy. And they are hosting 6 days of our training in their beautiful facility. And they have just been wonderful.
And a spectacular staff. You know, we in Hospitality Green go to both to colleges, hospitals, hotels, you name it. I've never had the customer service that we've had there. And the excellence in staff. The staff has just been fabulous, and Sean's been wonderful. Really a wonderful experience to be working there. They've taught us more about hospitality than I think anybody else. It's really delightful.
Amazing. That's so cool. It's such a beautiful place inside, too.
It's beautiful.
Betty Booth is Santa Fe Green Lodging Initiative Coordinator with the Santa Fe Watershed Association, and Evadne Giannini is with Hospitality Green, an environmental consulting firm. For more information, people can go to ewg.org, and also you can go to Santa Fe Watershed Association at sfwa.org, and you can also go to hospitalitygreen.com. Thank you so much, ladies, for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Margaret Moore Booker. She is author of the new book, Southwest Art Defined, an Illustrated Guide. And on Thursday of this week at 6 o'clock, she will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore. We'll be joined by some artists whose work is featured in some ways in this book. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
Now, this is a big category, Southwest art, both in time and in the geographical area that it covers.
Yes, absolutely. But that was the important thing for me, is to get all of the arts within that region in this book.
So we're talking about New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, Colorado.
Yes.
And so what was the motivation for you to put together this book?
Well, I really felt there was a need for it in my own projects, in my own writing projects. I wanted a book like that so I could look things up, quickly, and I wanted a good source. And I found that, I was looking in, 20 different books to get a decent definition for a particular technique or material or art form that was made in the Southwest. So I just kind of went from there. And then when I kind of chatted with people in the field, gallery owners, museum curators, and various publishers, and everyone said that would be awesome because there isn't anything like that out there, So I wanted to get both Hispano and Native American arts and architecture, of the region in there.
And it's so tricky when you talk about what cultural categories you're going to put in the book, because there's so much cultural mixing that's happened over the millennia that your book covers.
Absolutely, and that's really tricky. And the other thing is that there's all this crossover, within techniques and materials and art forms within the various cultures that have lived here, over the centuries. For instance, I have a term for pinyon pitch, and it was used by early, well, I would say prehistoric and historic weavers, native weavers, to coat the inside and outside of their hand-woven baskets to make them watertight. Well, pinyon pitch was also used by the Navajos on their pottery, again, originally to make it watertight, and now they still use it, but it's more of a decorative feature. And then also Hispano artisans, Santeros, have used pinyon pitch as kind of the last varnish on their retablos. So I think that's, you know, really interesting. There's that crossover of the cultures, and it's a natural material, traditional material that a lot of them are still using.
So that's one of the things about this, and one of the nice things when you kind of flip through this book, I mean, it's sort of alphabetical from... what, Akama to Zuni, kind of?
pretty much, yeah.
But the materials really figure heavily in it, and I think one of the common threads in this book is the use of natural materials and the create, as you gave with that example of pinyon pitch, the very creative use of natural materials.
Yeah, absolutely, because as an art historian and a collector, it's a particular interest of mine. You know, if I have a piece of basketry or pottery that I either purchased or just admire at a museum collection, I want to know, you know, how it was made. And so, you know, I wanted to include all the different materials, you know, from the plants, you know, yucca to clay, and as I said, pinyon pitch. And then, you know, I researched them all and discovered how they were used. And that was one of the interesting things, too, is that, you know, we look at these works of art and think we don't understand, I think, the labor that goes into them. You know, for instance, basketry, native basket makers, you know, have to pick their own materials, and they can only do it a certain time of year. And then they have to dry it, and then they have to wet it again so it's pliable, and then they might dye it, and then they have to split, you know, if it's a leaf or, say, a stalk of yucca, they have to split it into little sewing elements. And then just the process itself of weaving takes a long time. So it was just, again, really fascinating to go through that whole process, you know, with them in a way, you know, discover the materials and then bring it all the way up to the techniques they use to make the pieces and design elements and that kind of thing.
For you as you say, a collector and an art historian, that kind of understanding of materials and processes gives you such an insight into how the work is made and the quality of any particular piece when you start looking at the details of that use of materials.
Yeah, that's true. I do have a long background in art history and have studied the arts of this region for probably 15 years or so on my own. And then when it came to working on this book, I did consult a lot of published sources and scholars in the field and artists themselves. But yeah, I'd say my husband and I have developed a good eye over the year, you know, because we've just looked at so much material out there and so many, you know, works of art and traveled, you know, to the Hopi Mesas and gone to the Spanish market and India market every year for, I don't know, 15 years. And yeah.
And you, I would think, also have a very good eye for authentic versus copy kind of work.
Yes. I mean, that's unfortunate because, for instance, with basketry, there are a lot of fakes out there. And we have a pretty good eye for that, definitely.
How can you spot a fake in some of the different kinds of Southwestern art that you work with?
Oh, gosh. It'd be hard to do that without having them physically in front of me to show you. But usually it's going to be, you can see a lack of skill and the materials just aren't quite right. You know, you can tell the dye is just a strange color in a basket or, it's actually tricky. It's definitely tricky.
What are some of the other natural materials that we use here in the Southwest and that Native people and Hispanos and everybody else has been using over the centuries?
Oh, gosh, there are so many. And used for all different things, from architecture, you know, mud, of course, for architecture. And mud is also used for one of my favorite art forms. They're called mud toys, and they're made by Navajo women, and they're literally just mud that's formed usually into a figure, and then it's dried in the sun, and then painted. and that's it. And they're just charming little works of art. So there's mud, there's the yucca plant for weaving, wool, of course, for textiles.
There was a part in your book where you have an entry on tree ring dating, and I thought, why does she have tree ring dating in a book on Southwestern art? It's because of the Vigas.
Exactly. It's one way to date a historic structure is they take a little sample of the Viga wood, and they can date it by this process. And because I'm also extremely interested in architecture, I wanted to have as many terms in the book relating to architecture as I could.
Yeah.
So that's why that's in there, yeah.
And there's entries in the book. I mean, again, it's full of lots of nice little surprises, and one of them was bungalow.
Yes, again, that's a favorite architectural style of mine, and there are a lot of really wonderful examples in Santa Fe, for instance, and in Tucson and elsewhere in the Southwest. And so I included it, and I tried to, mention that the style is adapted in some regards, regionally. So, for instance, sometimes the bungalows actually have walls of adobe or stucco that might be a little different than you'd see elsewhere in the country.
And the thing about the bungalow entry that was interesting to me is that the form of it was designed for very hot climates because it kept the heat out and let the air flow through in a way that kept people from baking in the summers. And there's a lot of things like that where kind of low-tech technologies for staying sane in this climate, whether it be hot or cold, are in there without all of our modern technological achievements.
Right. I guess with the bungalows also, you're thinking of the porches, these very expansive porches and sleeping rooms, and then, sleeping rooms that are partly outdoors. In Arizona, they call it the Arizona room. It's a porch basically enclosed, but lets the breezes come through and cool you down at night and that kind of thing.
So let's talk about your own journey in collecting. We're talking to Margaret Moore Booker about her book, Southwest Art Defined. Now, how did you start collecting Southwestern art?
Well, I came out here in the early 90s, and I went to a trading post, and I saw this incredible pot, a tiny little black-on-black Santa Clara pot, and I was just amazed by it. It was, and when I learned the history behind it and the techniques involved in it, I had to have it, and I wanted to investigate it further, and I went to Santa Clara Pueblo and chatted with artisans there and learned more about the piece. But so it was that trip out here. I was on my own and just fell in love with this piece. And then my husband came back with me on subsequent trips, and he bought his first little pot at San Ildefonso, and he was hooked. And we just kind of carried on from there. And he got into basketry, and then I got into textiles and jewelry, and it just went on from there.
So with the pottery that you bought, the first little piece at Santa Clara, which there's a beautiful photograph of in the book, there is this whole world of pottery that was really made not so much for utilitarian use, carrying things, carrying water, whatever, but really for sale, for the market.
Yeah, I'd say beginning in the late 19th century, the potters started making pottery specifically for sale. And they would use specific patterns and forms that they found were appealing to tourists. And so they did kind of change their art to appeal to the public because they needed to make a living. But they also still use traditional techniques, and the designs, too, are also traditional. So, they did kind of change what was a functional item into a tourist item, but then ultimately also a work of art.
So in your journey of collecting and writing this book, did you get to kind of go behind the scenes and see how for example, Chimayo textiles were made, or Santa Clara pots, or other kinds of baskets or things that you cover in this book?
Yes, absolutely. On various trips around the Southwest, sometimes we would attend artist demonstrations. For instance, we were in Tucson around the time they had a fair, and we were able to watch Tohono O'odham basket weavers make willow and devil's claw baskets. So sometimes it was just good timing, but other times we sought out specific artists. We were at the Hopi Mesas, and we sought out Dexter Nampeo, who's a fairly well-known artist, potter. And she didn't have any pieces because she's so famous, you pretty much have to get your name on a list.
Oh, my goodness.
But she was just wonderful because she took the time to tell us about the process, and she took us out back to her studio, which was basically a shed, and showed us how she uses the traditional technique in firing her pottery. And it was really quite funny because she was adamant about the type of sheep manure that she used for fuel.
Not just any sheep manure.
Not just any sheep manure. It had to be picked up in the field a certain time of year, and it had to be a certain type of, it had to be a certain thickness and I would say firmness. And it was really quite interesting. And so we have, my husband and I have wonderful stories about, you know, meeting the different artists, and they're telling us these techniques.
That's so interesting because, I mean, these are the, really, these are the kind of chemists and physicists of Native arts.
Right, right. That's true.
Now, tell us some of the other places that you visited and people you met.
We've been to the Navajo Reservation quite a few times, and we tracked down a basket maker named Sally Black. And we just happened to arrive when she was working on a basket that shows, it's a pictorial basket that shows the coyote, who was a trickster, basically creating the stars in the heavens. And my husband just fell in love with it right away. But what was cool is she was working on it, and she was splitting the yucca leaves into the, you know, really thin strips that she could use for sewing and or weaving. And we noticed that she had a gold tooth in her front, you know. And she said, yeah, because she'd been splitting those yucca leaves for so long that it wore down her tooth. So
oh, my goodness.
She had to get a gold tooth to cap, you know. And anyway, it was kind of funny.
We're talking to Margaret Moore Booker about her book, Southwest Art Defined. So tell us about the process of writing this book. I mean, it's kind of, I don't know if we want to call it encyclopedic, but it's a kind of A to Z, very beautifully illustrated with fantastic photographs. And you must have, I mean, it must have been on some level of a big and somewhat collaborative project.
Yes, it was definitely collaborative. I did the initial research, you know, searching out scholarly articles and books on the subjects. And then I spoke to artisans, and I contacted various scholars in the field, and I attended as many museum exhibitions as I could. And so I pulled the text together, and then at the very end we sent it out to different specialists in the field. For instance, Jonathan Batkin at the Wheelwright Museum, Carmela Padilla in Santa Fe to read the Hispano entries, and it kind of opened up a whole dialogue between myself and scholars and artisans out there. And it turned out I did a pretty good job, but there were definitely some things they thought I needed to explore more, or a couple things that were not quite right. But in general, that was a really good collaborative process at the very end.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a vast sweep of topics that I guess no one person could really encompass all that knowledge.
Exactly. There's no way I could be a specialist in all these fields. I mean, as I said, I did my best with the research and talking to artists and incorporated my own knowledge, you know, from being out there and meeting with artists. But I really needed that expertise, you know, to have a look at the manuscript at the end.
Talk about the process of collecting. It's something that I've actually been interested in for a long time. It seems like collecting is almost genetic. I mean, there are kids who collected bottle caps in the old days. There are people who collect impressionist art. It doesn't matter how big the ticket is. It's like there's a kind of focus and almost obsession that collectors seem to have.
Yeah, and I think it starts with your being drawn, you know, to a particular art form. And then, you know, say with pottery, well, okay, I have my little piece of Santa Clara pottery, but now I want a piece of micaceous pottery made by, say, Felipe Ortega, who's a famous micaceous potter out here in New Mexico. I don't know, it becomes infectious, and it's almost like an addiction. You know, all of a sudden you want examples by other artists or other, you know, materials, or and you just get excited by it. And as an art historian, you know, I worked in art museums for a long time, and I got to handle wonderful objects. And there's nothing more thrilling in this world, at least for me, than holding in my hand a work of art that I know someone has labored over and, you know, has such a creative flair. And I don't know, it's just something really special, I think, for collectors.
And there's a kind of like, as you say, you have one piece and then you need to round out the collection, and the collection seems to be an illustration of some whole. I mean, whatever the scope of that area is that you are collecting within, it seems like there's a sense at a certain point, okay, we've completed this. Is that true?
Yeah, that is true. In fact, we've reached it. You also run out of space. That's another really big issue.
Right.
But yeah, I think you reach a point where you feel like you have beautiful examples of work that you wanted, and it, you know, brings you joy every day, and you know, you have it in various spots in your house. And I think my husband and I both feel like we have these beautiful examples and don't need to carry forward. However, having said that, we just were at the Indian Art Market in at the Heard Museum in Tucson, Arizona, and both of us succumbed. And I purchased a beautiful little pot by Goldenrod. And so, you know, it's really hard to stop. But I think you do, you know, reach a point where you feel like you do have a full collection. And some of that might stem, too, from my museum days, you know, and you kind of want an example of this, this, and this. It's almost like having an exhibition in your house. And
right.
Then you reach the point where you feel like you're done. You've got it. You've got everything you wanted, and you can just enjoy what you have and still go to the shows and maybe not purchase something, but it's hard.
Now, do you get together with other collectors? Are you kind of a network of people who talk to each other about what you're doing?
You know, we don't. There are certainly organizations and groups out there. I know the various museums have collectors groups, but we actually don't do that. We're I don't know.
are collectors competitive with each other?
They definitely are competitive. Well, you probably know how at Indian Market, you know, you to get there at 5 in the morning if you want to purchase a work by a specific, you know, well-known artist. So and I think now you have to put your name on a list and stand in line and so forth. And, oh, yeah, they're definitely. And how it goes is if you're at one of these shows, if you have the piece in your hand, then it's basically yours if you want it. So you don't put it down. If you're thinking about it, don't put it down, because someone else will pick it up and say, it's mine now. So it's weird, but yes, there is definitely this competitiveness. We've experienced that, and it's a little weird, you know, but anyway.
Well, this book, Southwest Art Defined, I would think it would be something that would be very helpful not only to scholars and students, but to collectors.
Absolutely, yeah, because it has, as we've discussed, all the different techniques and materials and forms and designs in there. And so, yeah, I really saw it as a reference work for collectors, for museum staff, for librarians, for students, even writers, because that's how it started for me, and anyone interested in the Southwest. It is kind of like a dictionary, and it is alphabetical, but it really is a pleasure just to sit down with it and leaf through it because of the beautiful photographs and interesting technique. And I think Rio Nuevo published this, and they are out of Tucson, And I'm just so pleased with what they did. It just really came together beautifully. The organizing of the photographs was no small matter. And they did photograph quite a few things from our own collection, but then we also got photographs from museums and galleries and other private collectors. We tried to find examples that best illustrated whatever the term was, whether it was a fetish or a Cordova wood carving or textile.
Or a petroglyph.
Or a petroglyph. Or a bungalow or an adobe, you know, Spanish Pueblo revival style house. Or,
right.
Yeah.
Now, you will be at Collected Works tomorrow evening at 6 o'clock, and you have some artists with you. Tell us about who's going to be joining you.
Yes, I'm really pleased to have four different artists who will demonstrate crafts that are illustrated or discussed, rather, in the book. We have Melvin Sandoval, who is a traditional fetish carver from San Felipe. He's also of Zuni Pueblo descent. We have Nicholas Otero, who's a New Mexican Santero, and he will demonstrate retablo making, again, using traditional techniques. And we have Felipe Ortega, who's a potter here in New Mexico. He's of Apache and Hispano descent, and he will demonstrate his micaceous pottery. And we have Rachel Roybal Montoya. She's from born and bred in northern New Mexico, and she will demonstrate her filigree jewelry. And lastly, we will have David McElroy, who's actually a newcomer to Santa Fe. He's a member of the Choctaw Nation, and he's going to demonstrate silver work, in particular the repoussé technique. He's been heavily influenced by Navajo silver work, and so he will join us tomorrow.
Margaret Moore Booker is author of the book Southwest Art Defined, An Illustrated Guide. And once again, she will be at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow, Thursday at 6 o'clock. And Collected Works Bookstore is on Galisteo Street on the corner of Water Street right here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
And we've just got a couple of minutes left right now. I wanted to welcome Jason Silverman. He's the director of the Cinematheque at the CCA. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for being with us last week on the fundraiser. We did very well, and I thank all our listeners for contributing. Now, what have you got coming up at the CCA? You have the most amazing film program anywhere. Well, we've got a bunch of great film programs here, but what do you have coming up?
Oh, wow. It boggles the mind. We started a new partnership with the New Mexico Film Office. You know, New Mexico has such an incredible film community and homegrown, and so there's a lot of great films being made and a lot of interesting filmmakers working. We're doing two programs a month with the film office under the title The New Mexico Filmmakers Experience. Last week we did a panel discussion on composers, which was packed, and this week we're showing a film from Julie Reichert, who is an Albuquerque filmmaker. It's called Warrior Woman, and we'll be showing that on Saturday and Sunday. And then on Friday we open one of the most powerful documentaries you'll ever see. You got a chance to see it.
Now, I just want to say, The Warrior Woman is about a cancer survivor who's tormented by crazy dreams. It looks to be a very interesting film.
It's very intense. It's very intense.
So Gatekeepers, that's another film that you are opening at the CCA, and I saw a preview of that film. It's one of the best documentaries I've ever seen, Oscar-nominated documentary.
Yeah, I think you just said it. It's one of the best documentaries. You know, it's hard to even conceptualize what this man pulled off. Dror Murray, the filmmaker, managed to interview all six of the former Shin Bet directors. Shin Bet is kind of a combination of the CIA and FBI in Israel, and they've overseen monitoring, surveillance, etc., interrogation of Palestinians since early on. And so these six men have made the decisions, the choices, that have defined Israel's policy towards the Palestinians.
And here they are, all retired, speaking out and reflecting on those decisions.
None of them have spoken in public like this before.
Ever.
So having one of them would be miraculous. He has all six. So you get to follow basically the modern history of terrorism, counterterrorism, and you get an insight into this intractable situation in ways that are unbelievable. It's a really artfully made film and very powerful.
All of this is happening at the CCA. The number over there is 982-1338. They're at ccasantafe.org. Jason Silverman, thank you so much for being with us.
Always a pleasure.